Good afternoon and welcome to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community. Your host is Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community. This hour is designed to inspire, inform, and to help you live better with cancer. Now, here's your host, Kim Tibaldo.
Welcome to Frankly Speaking About Cancer, an internet radio show that focuses on informing and inspiring people to live well with cancer. I'm your host, Kim Tibaldo, Executive Chair of the Cancer Support Community. For more than 35 years, we at the Cancer Support Community have been a relentless ally for anyone impacted by cancer. We help individuals manage the realities of this disruptive disease and get back to normal. Whether accessing our free services in person or at one of our 175 locations, online or over our toll-free helpline, you're getting a team of licensed professionals providing patient navigation, financial counseling, genetic counseling, pediatric support, and more. The phrase "do no harm" is as foundational to the practice of medicine as "we the people" is to American democracy. Yet, as the past year has shown in example after heartbreaking example, not all people are treated equally or well by the American healthcare system. COVID is just the most recent example of how healthcare inequity harms communities of color, gender diversity, and creates economic hardships. Today's guest has been working since he was in medical school to change this trajectory by educating and empowering members of the Black community, his community, to address the critical health issues that affect them. Dr. Joseph Ravenel is a general internist, clinical educator, and clinician investigator with a health equity research focus. He is currently the director of the Cancer Prevention Navigation Program of the Perlmutter Cancer Center at NYU Langone Health. He also serves as professor of population health and medicine and associate dean for diversity affairs and inclusion at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine. Dr. Ravenel is also co-director of the Beatrice W. Welters Breast Health Outreach and Navigation Program, which helps women in underserved communities access breast cancer diagnosis, treatment, and support services. In 2010, he launched the Men's Health Initiative, a community-based research and outreach program to address health inequities in New York City. Dr. Ravenel, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Kim. It's a real honor for me to be on your show today.
Well, I'm going to jump right in. We have a lot to cover, Dr. Ravenel. You have been a passionate advocate for better health outcomes in the Black community for a long time. And I'm wondering, of all the many paths you could have taken, what led you to use research to achieve this goal, and how did it lead to your project, Brotherhood?
So I am the son of two ministers, actually, I knew pretty early on that I did not want to don the cloth, so to speak. I was always interested in medicine, and I had in my first year in medical school an experience where I worked with one of my most influential mentors, Dr. Eric Whitaker, to really understand why Black men in Chicago didn't utilize primary care to the level you might expect for a group of people who have the highest death rates from many conditions like high blood pressure, colorectal cancer, and others that are amenable to prevention and treatment with early identification. I learned in that first summer some of the barriers that Black men face in trying to access primary care and what some of their attitudes and perceptions were around receiving health. Around receiving health care. And as it turns out, before I graduated from medical school, we were able to present our research findings from talking to over 100 Black men in that one single summer, which ended up in us receiving funding to actually start Project Brotherhood in Chicago, a Black men's clinic staffed by black male doctors, but also had a terrific focus on the social determinants of health, which we learned really were at the root of some of the reasons that Black men did not seek primary health care.
So, Dr. Ravenel, I'll dive down a little bit deeper. Tell us more about what you were looking for in that study. What was the focus? What did you hope to learn?
So we hoped to learn two major things. What are Black men's perceptions about health? And two, what are some of the barriers that keep men away from utilizing primary care and preventive services generally, things like cancer screening? And so we learned a couple of critical lessons. The first lesson we learned was that Black men think about health in a much broader way than we traditionally framed health. So among the 100 men or so that we spoke with, health was about more than just having a good blood pressure, about not being overweight, about having a good blood sugar. But it also included things like feeling good about yourself, about looking good, about being able to have a job, being able to impart lessons to your children, and being able to safely navigate your neighborhood to get to know your neighbors. And if you didn't have all of those things, even if you felt good, many of the men did not consider themselves to be healthy. And we wanted to also understand what kept them away from utilizing primary health care services. And for many of the men, it was having personally had negative experiences accessing health in the past, either in the form of not being treated with respect when they came into a clinical setting, feeling that they experienced racism. There was a lot of medical mistrust related to the Tuskegee experiment that was well known among the men that we spoke with. And it is amazing how relevant those conversations we had back then, you know, over 20 years ago, how relevant those conversations mm-hmm. are to medical trust or mistrust today.
That's right. That's right. Dr. Ravenel, can you help our listeners understand the importance of barbershops in the Black community? What makes them such a safe and trusted space? We've seen the evolution of this in the context of men's well-being. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So one of the real innovations of Project Brotherhood was that it actually brought barbers into the clinical setting as an incentive for men to come and get care. And I think that really speaks to how important barbershops and barbers are in the Black community. So today, barbershops in the Black community serve as places where men know they can come, where they're going to find camaraderie, they're going to find compassion, they're going to find solace, and they're going to actually connect with a group of men that they see often every 2 weeks, including their barber. And we learned that on average, Black men have been with their barber for over 7 years. And so if you think about that for a minute, right? If you're going and seeing someone every 2 weeks, you develop an incredible relationship with that person, actually very different from the relationships that we often form in healthcare, where we're seeing our doctors, you know, and our providers, you know, a couple times a year. And so what we see in the barbershops are manyfold. One, it is a safe space that is really conducive to conversations, and it's a place where you can trust the people in there to both guard your secrets as well as to give you advice on a whole range of things, whether you've asked for the advice or not.
So I it's a very unique strategy asking barbers to serve as healthcare communicators. Can you just take a quick minute to walk us through the training process of these barbers?
Yes. So it turns out that barbers actually see great value in healthcare. Back in the Renaissance days, barbers were actually called barber surgeons because they used to perform minor medical procedures in addition to providing grooming services, and that tradition actually carries through to current barber training. In almost every state, barbers have to be licensed, which means that they have to undergo some type of formal training. And we learned from barbers both in Texas as well as here in New York City, where I am currently, that health really is pervasive in the curricula that barbers have to participate in. And so when we approached barbers and let them know about our idea of actually partnering with them to identify a condition like high blood pressure in their customers, to try to help their customers live longer, more fulfilling lives, they were right on board, and it took very little convincing for us to get them on board. And so when I was in Dallas, Texas, we actually got funding from the National Institutes of Health and a couple of other funding agencies to actually teach barbers how to measure blood pressure and how to counsel their customers on going to the doctor if their blood pressure was high. And when I came to New York City, I partnered with several folks in the cancer screening world, and we basically extended the idea from measuring blood pressure to also focusing on cancer screening, and specifically colorectal cancer screening.
Well, I know we're going to get to that in our next segment. Just very quickly, we're coming to our coming to a break here, Dr. Ravenel. But just quickly, what tell me a lesson or two that you learned from this experience and the study itself.
So I learned one that barbers are phenomenally talented people who know how to connect to people and how to get their customers, to really get involved in their health. They are incredible allies. They are trusted key opinion leaders. And, whenever we're talking about health equity for any community, I think finding those trusted leaders in whatever community you are talking about, that really is the key to us starting to achieve equity.
Yeah, I think that word trust is a word that we're talking about a lot these days, and I think you're absolutely right. Looking back at a study from so many years ago, we are having this conversation yet again, in the context of COVID. This is, frankly speaking, about cancer. We're talking with Dr. Ravenel. We have to take a quick commercial break here, but when we come back, we've got a lot to continue with our conversation with Dr. Ravenel. So trust me, you're not going to want to miss a second of this conversation. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm Kim Thibodeau. We will be right back after the break.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The Cancer Support Community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the Cancer Support Community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355 or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope.
People living with breast cancer often find it difficult to ask for help, and many of the people in their lives want to help but don't know how. During National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, Cancer Support Community is proud to support Meal Train, sponsored by Magnolia, which utilizes MealTrain.com, a free shared online calendar to streamline the process of giving and receiving meals for families coping with breast cancer. Help us reach our goal of 1,000 new breast cancer-specific meal trains this October. To learn more, visit MealTrain.com/MMT and enter the code MAGNOLIAB, or visit us at cancersupportcommunity.org.
your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer. Today we're talking with Dr. Joseph Ravenel and learning more about his efforts to combat disparities in healthcare and improve the health outcomes of Black men and women. Dr. Ravenel is a general internist, clinical educator, and a clinician investigator with a health equity research focus. Dr. Ravenel, I first saw you speak a few years ago at the Biden Cancer Summit in Washington, D.C., where you shared the moving story about your friend who had died of colorectal cancer and how his experience influenced your next barbershop initiative and intervention. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. So my barbershop work started in Dallas, Texas. As I described, we were focusing on hypertension, which is a major killer of Black men. And so the husband of one of my team members, he really took me under his wing when I moved from New York City down to Dallas, Texas, and we developed an incredible friendship. And so when I made the move back to New York City from Dallas after working with his wife for several years, I got the news that he actually was diagnosed with colorectal cancer. And at the time, he was about 60 years old, he actually got diagnosed on his very first colonoscopy. And I couldn't help but think, had colorectal cancer been a focus for our barbershop work in Dallas, and had we been able to get him screened earlier, that we very likely could have saved the life of an incredible, incredible man. And so that memory actually stays with me as I think about all of the work that I am doing, and I think about every single man that I come into contact with, and it makes me believe that I really have to. It really is a calling for me to try to get as many men screened as possible, because with timely screening, as you know, Kim, we can actually prevent people from dying from this terrible disease.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And of course, we're seeing an emerging change in the guidelines for colorectal cancer from the age of 50 to the age of 45. So a whole new wave of having to communicate some of the new recommendations. But I'm curious, Dr. Ravenel, was tackling colorectal cancer different from tackling hypertension and heart disease? I can imagine that people might be uncomfortable talking about a necessary, but what could be considered an invasive screening like a colonoscopy while getting a haircut, the prep, and everything that's involved. So compare and contrast for me.
So you hit it right on the head, Kim, that talking about colorectal cancer is infinitely more difficult than talking about high blood pressure. And one of the things that makes it more difficult is there is an incredible awareness of hypertension within the Black community. In fact, national data suggests that over 80% of Black Americans who have hypertension know that they have it. The same is certainly not true of colorectal cancer. And in fact, what we found was that many Black men knew that they were at higher risk for prostate cancer, but didn't know that Black men have the highest incidence or the highest occurrence of colorectal cancer compared to any other group. Number one, talking about cancer, I think, is more scary for most people than talking about high blood pressure. And then once we get to what the actual screening procedure is, and as you mentioned, that it is perceived as a very invasive procedure, talking about that was definitely more difficult than talking about high blood pressure. But what we found was, by actually going to the barbershop and approaching men first about high blood pressure, being able to establish a rapport around that topic that's fairly easy to talk about, and then being able to transition to talking about colorectal cancer, we found that strategy to be very successful. But whereas we were very easily able to convince men to put a blood pressure cuff on to get their blood pressure taken, it often took more than one visit or one attempt at a barbershop to convince men that they needed to either undergo a colonoscopy or to participate in stool-based testing.
Got it. Dr. Ravenel, when I introduced you at the beginning of the show, I mentioned your work with the Beatrice W. Welter's Breast Health Outreach and Navigation Program. Tell our listeners more about this program, and I'm wondering, after years of working with men in the barbershop, has it been a different experience reaching out to women? I'm going to guess the answer is yes.
So, yes, definitely different. And, you know, the Beatrice Welter's program, really, we are very fortunate at NYU to have Mrs. Beatrice Welter's. She is the one who generously funded the development of this program, which has been going strong for the last 6 years. And that program was really built around the model of outreach that we were able to prove successful for reaching men around colorectal cancer. And so we basically took that same model, and rather than focusing exclusively on colorectal cancer in barbershops, we actually went to places where women congregate. We went to churches, we went to beauty salons, fitness classes, lots of different community venues, and really went out there with the mission of educating and navigating as many women as possible for breast cancer screening, but not just stopping there, but also if anyone was found to have any type of breast health issue, including breast cancer, to not just stop at the screening, but also to guide them, to navigate women to diagnostic resolution, and ultimately to treatment and, when appropriate, cancer clinical trials. And through that program, with incredibly dedicated navigators, we have been able to do outreach with over 18,000 women, and we have navigated over 1,000 women to breast health imaging and other types of appointments. We also have diagnosed over 20 breast cancers in women that I'm positive would not have otherwise been diagnosed. Wow. And also been able to navigate a number of women to cancer clinical trials, something that we know is underutilized by minority populations.
Congratulations. Wow, some great numbers there, and so great to hear about that community outreach. Dr. Ravenel, the Centers for Disease Control has identified racism as a serious public health threat, and it worsens all other risk factors in underserved communities. So for listeners who may not be aware of the scope of the problem, you know, what does that mean exactly? You mentioned earlier in the show that phrase, social determinants of health. So what is the connection between racism, risk factors, and barriers to care?
So thank you for highlighting that point, Kim. I am so happy that the CDC has recognized racism as a serious threat to public health. I have long maintained that when it comes to social determinants of health, that is those things that are outside of the purview of the medical system, I have always felt that racism is the number one social determinant of health for people of color, and specifically Black people, because as you just said, Kim, it affects so many other factors downstream. The history of structural racism in this country that goes all the way back to the days of slavery. And then with Reconstruction and Jim Crow, there has been systemic oppression and actually policies that have actually differentiated the healthcare that has been possible for Black people in this country. Is like redlining, where in which neighborhoods where there are lots of Black and brown people were basically given a lower credit rating, which basically was a disincentive for businesses to invest in these communities. We have seen the impact of that, which has resulted in differential access to education, differential access to employment opportunities, and ultimately differential access to healthcare. And we saw that really manifest in a big way with COVID, where we saw differential access to COVID testing and several other services. But that really is kind of, COVID is really the example for disparities that we have seen long before COVID, like disparities in colorectal cancer, disparities in breast cancer, and a number of other conditions. And when we think about disparities, yes, we do think that there are some biological mechanisms that are probably at play, but we believe that the major mechanisms really are much more related to social determinants, including access to quality health care.
So you're making some really interesting and important points here, Dr. Ravenel. The sad part about this for me is that we're coming up on our break here, and I have so much more that I would like to discuss with you. I know we have some other guests coming up in the show. I just want to thank you so much for joining us today, sharing your experiences and insights. I do hope you'll come back, because I would like to talk more about COVID. I'd like to talk more about the vaccines, and there's so much more that I would like to share with our listeners and learn from you in the conversation. So I do hope you'll come back. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm Kim Thibodeau. We're going to take a quick break, but don't go away. We will be right back.
Cancer. It's a lonely word. Terms I don't understand. Choices I never thought I'd have to make. But there is hope and help.
Support from cancer survivors.
Links to research and clinical trials.
Help with finances and access to care.
All behind you at Breakaway from Cancer, created by Amgen to empower cancer patients.
The cancer support community is proud to be a partner of Breakaway from Cancer.
Hi, I'm Nick Nicolaides, President and CEO of Morphotech, and we're delighted to be a sponsor of Cancer Support Community's Frankly Speaking About Cancer series. Morphotech and its parent company, Eisai, are committed to human healthcare, and we recognize that patients and their families are the most important participants in the healthcare process. We salute our global advocacy partners who are devoted to improving the lives of people touched by cancer every day.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The Cancer Support Community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the Cancer Support Community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355 or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm your host, Kim Tibaldo. We're going to continue our in-depth look at efforts to combat disparities in healthcare and improving health outcomes for Black men with our next guest, David Brown. Well, Dr. Ravenel would be the first to tell you that the success of initiatives like the Men's Health Initiative and other work that's happening in the community depends in large part on the dedication of peer advocates like David Brown, who do the delicate work of reaching out to Black men and persuading them to take a leap of faith and get screened for hypertension, colorectal cancer, and other diseases that disproportionately affect their community. It is a job for which he is especially well-suited. Professional musician, a percussionist to be precise, with a strong spiritual practice, David spent 15 years performing, teaching, and preaching in Japan. Ultimately, he returned to his roots in the United States, where he looked for new ways to give back. After serving as youth minister in Queens, New York, he joined the Division of Decision Science at New York University's Grossman School of Medicine, where he met Dr. Ravenel and began his new career as a community health worker. David, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Well, you've come to a very traditional discipline, medicine, through a very untraditional route. How did you connect with Dr. Ravenel, the Men's Health Initiative, and what were your initial impressions of the project?
So I connected with Dr. Ravenel I was looking for work when I had recently come back from Japan. I was working at a church as a youth minister and was running a basketball program there as well. But I was also looking for full-time work. And one of the members of the church let me know about a position that was open at NYU as a CHW. And so I just went on the interview. And it was successful, and that's how we got started. That was when I first met Dr. Rav, as we call him.
Dr. Rav. Well, that sounds
great.
Yeah,
we call him Dr. Rav.
Yeah.
My impression of the program, I thought it was, I was impressed with it because it was based in service. And, I'm always impressed with any program that has to do with trying to serve the community and trying to combat issues and solve problems that they're facing. So that was like a big draw for me.
Well, and I love that career networking at church. My oldest brother's a minister, so he'd love to hear that story. That's great.
Right, no doubt. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's great. Great networking. Yeah. David, I'm curious, how did the barbershop owners respond to you and your invitation? What were those conversations like? Where did they take place? How did you build that trust?
Okay, so what we did, firstly, we kind of canvassed neighborhoods to get a sense of what barbershops were in certain areas, like in Harlem and Brooklyn, and we worked throughout the five boroughs, so that's how we kind of got in a sense of where we would go. And then, we would just typically just go into a barbershop and ask to speak to the owner, and if the owner was there, we would just explain we would introduce ourselves and explain as briefly as possible what we would like to do, like the way we'd like to partner with them, what the program entailed. And we had little packets with us that we could leave with them information and whatnot. And then, they would – typically these guys would be pretty open to – because barbershop owners tend to be like unofficial community leaders, because in a barbershop, so many issues get discussed in the barbershop. That's kind of just important to Black men in particular. So those conversations would go pretty well. I mean, occasionally we might be met with a bit of, skepticism. But for the most part, we were successful in convincing them that it was something worth doing. And, we also offered an incentive too. So, it
would
go pretty well.
I love it. David, take us through a typical day, reaching out to customers at a barbershop, if there is such thing as a typical day. How do you begin the process? How do you break the ice? How do you kind of set it up?
Okay, so, we would when we were doing the blood pressure initiative, it was a little easier because we would set a tent up outside the shop, you know, and so guys could kind of see what we were doing as they entered the barbershop. So it was just a matter of, it was easy to break the ice because we had we had the blood pressure machines there kind of as a way for them to kind of see what we're doing, you know. And so it'd just be a matter of, hey, man, you want to check your blood pressure today? You know, kind of a thing. And they are, sure, why not? You know, I think my pressure's good. You know, usually that's, you know, the response we get. And we also got the I'm good, nah, I'm good response, which was pretty prevalent as well. And when we had instances where guys might not want to do it, we would just kind of, well, it's only going to take a second. You know, how long it's going to take for you to, you know, check your pressure just to make sure that you're good, you know. And so, yeah, a lot of guys would sit at the table and, you know, we check the pressure and then we just explain what the results meant and we kind of take it from there. But, yeah, that was with the blood pressure. It was a little bit easier because we did have the table set up outside. And, of course, you had some guys who were kind of nervous to know what their blood pressure was, too. So, you know, we dealt with a lot of different dynamics in terms of that. But overall, it was, you know, we got a good response, you know.
But let's talk more about that. Nah, I'm good. You call it the nah, I'm good syndrome. And I know,
yeah,
you know, it can
exactly
be tough. I mean,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, you're approaching these strangers. You want to talk about, like, personal matters that can be, you know, maybe scary. Maybe they have no symptoms. They're thinking, oh, my God, is this going to cost me something? And then, no, I'm good, man. I'm good. You know, so how do you overcome that? No, I'm good. How do you get to the next step?
Well, if a guy's telling me he doesn't really want to check his blood pressure, the first thing I would appeal to is the fact that it doesn't take that long, like I said. And then we might talk about how it's a good thing to know your blood pressure, you know, just on, you know, I would say, well, how's your diet?
Yeah.
Because if I get a sense of what they're eating, then, you know, it might prompt them to think about, well, you know, I have been kind of picking out on, you know, fried food lately, or, you know, I do love my my bacon, egg, and cheese in the morning or whatever it is, you know. So things like that would kind of prompt them to, well, you know what, maybe I better check this to make sure I'm good, you know. And I would even say sometimes when they said, nah, I'm good, I would say, are you really good? You know, because, you know, as long as you're not being belligerent, you know, the guys are pretty friendly. So as long as they don't feel like they're being attacked or you don't make them feel guilty, you know, you might kind of persuade them to sit down and take. And a lot of times, too, if someone else was doing it, then they would do it, you know.
Right. That's great, right?
Yeah,
see a buddy, that's right, doing it, yeah. And I mean, come on, who doesn't love their bacon, you know? Who doesn't love their bacon, really? So.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you something else, too. Sometimes the owners would, before we even got a chance to try and convince them, the owner would literally come outside and force them to sit down, you know?
Yeah.
So that was a part of it, too, because of the rapport that they had, you know?
Yes, lead by example, right? Lead by example. Yeah. So now,
quickly,
we're starting to get up on a break here, David. But you know, so on site blood pressure, we sit down. It takes a minute, right? But that's a little different from a colorectal cancer screening, right? So how do you ramp up from doing a quick blood pressure to talking about something like a colonoscopy or a colon cancer screening?
Well, we would ask the guys, like, because the pressure had to read we had to get certain numbers in order to invite them into the next step. So if they passed that criteria, then we would let them know that we're also interested in getting men screened for colorectal cancer. We would ask if they had ever been screened before. And if they said no, then we would invite them to participate in the next part of the study, which would include like the navigation piece, where we would contact them by phone and give them more of an education about the process of getting screened. And then we would talk about the different types of screenings, like, you know, a FIT test or the colon cancer screening itself, like the colonoscopy. And we would just give them details and try and just, we would educate them basically. And, you know, if there were barriers, we would discuss those too and see if we could, you know, overcome those and get them to see the importance of getting screened. And hopefully they would agree to it, you know, but it was a process. It would take some time.
Sure. And just quickly, as we go to the break here, David, you're seeing some success. Are you able to convince folks to get in and get those screenings?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we definitely got guys to see the importance of doing it. But we were working with several different populations where we had a church arm and we had a barbershop arm. And the church arm tended to be a little more open to readily getting the screening. You know, barbershop, you got a lot of different type of people coming in from different backgrounds and socioeconomic backgrounds. So that could affect, you know, the way they see us being in the barbershop, the way they see dealing with something like cancer, you know. So it definitely, it varied in terms of their responses, but we had a pretty good, we were able to convince quite a lot of guys to go ahead on and see the value in getting it done.
Wow. Wow. Congratulations. It's just, it's great to hear, David, the success that you're having. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. We're talking with David Brown, and David is a community health worker and taking some community, somewhat unconventional approaches to reaching out to Black men in the community through barbershops to educate about health issues, to provide some on-the-spot screenings and educate about cancer screenings. We've got to take a quick break here, but don't go away. We have a lot more that we wanted to discuss with David. This is Kim Thibodeau, Frankly Speaking About Cancer. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Cancer Support Community is proud to be a partner of Magnolia Meals at Home, a new pilot program that aims to help patients by providing nourishing meals to households affected by breast cancer so loved ones can spend more quality time together. This program is currently available in and around two pilot cities, Andover, Massachusetts, and Woodcliffe Lake, New Jersey. Participants will receive one delivery of meals every month for up to 6 months when enrolled in the program. Each delivery includes up to 7 meals designed to help meet the nutritional needs of people living with breast cancer and 10 meals for family members. This novel program is brought to you by the AZI Women's Oncology Program, Magnolia, Cancer Care, the Cancer Support Community, and Meals on Wheels Association of America. To find out if you or loved ones are eligible, visit online at www.magnoliameals.com. Or call 617-733-5848.
Effective cancer treatment requires more than just medication or surgery. For the country's 12 million cancer survivors and their loved ones, the social and emotional challenges of adapting to life with cancer are ongoing. How to handle coworkers' questions, how to get comfortable with new physical realities, how to reassure worried family members, or explain to friends your priorities have changed. The Cancer Support Community is ready to help by providing free counseling, education, and hope for survivors and their caregivers. Whether online or at over 100 locations around the world, the Cancer Support Community is ready to offer the support you need to live a better life with cancer. For more information on support groups, publications, nutrition, exercise programs, and more, call 1-888-793-9355. Or visit us online at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org. The Cancer Support Community, a global network of education and hope.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to Frankly Speaking About Cancer with the Cancer Support Community, an inspirational program offering the resources you need to live a better life with cancer. Now here's your host, Kim Thibodeau, President and CEO of the Cancer Support Community.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm your host, Kim Thibodeau. With me is David Brown, a former musician and preacher who now works as a peer advocate at the Division of Decision Science at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine. We've been having a fascinating conversation about his work helping to combat disparities in healthcare and improving outcomes for black men. David has worked closely with Dr. Joseph Ravenel, Dr. Rav, as they call him, who was with us earlier in the show. David, in your work, you use many of the same skills, I imagine, you perfected as a preacher, as a musician: sensitivity, empathy, and ability to improvise, and understanding of human nature. When you began your work as a community health worker, did you expect that those experiences would serve you in this work?
Well, I think that, I'm pretty sure it definitely translated into what I'm doing in terms of community work, because it's kind of the same thing. You're connecting with people, and as a musician, definitely just kind of vibing with people, and when you're in a situation musically, and everybody's feeling good because you're all on the same wavelength, and it's great, and you're all kind of, it's like a moment of peace between strangers, you know what I mean? And that definitely, I think, contributed to, this issue of just being able to connect with people. And then definitely just from a spiritual standpoint, for sure, I really feel like that the issue of what true leadership really looks like or really is, which has 100% to do with being in service to other people, definitely those scriptures, and really learning how to put other people first, and not to think so much of yourself that you're not willing to put yourself out there for someone else, definitely helped me to prepare to do work, connecting with community, and it definitely helped tremendously.
That's great. That's great. I love that. I love that. David, the COVID pandemic had revealed some pretty ugly truths about systemic racism in our nation, about inequities in healthcare, barriers to care, lack of trust in the system experienced by so many people of color in our country. You've been on the front lines for over a decade, engaging with real people and their concerns in a really, personal way. So what are the concerns and doubts that people have shared with you? What would you like, healthcare professionals to know, and talk about the importance of trust?
Well, okay, so I think one of the biggest things, obviously we encounter, depending on what neighborhood we were in, we encountered lots of folks that had their doubts about maybe not so much us, but the healthcare system in general. And I think it just comes from a place of, having dealt with, the blatant racism that's definitely it's just systemic in our country. So some of the things we've heard have been that, the system just can't be trusted because they've never really had our best interests at heart. So why are you guys any different, or why is this different from how it's always been? And for me, I think one of the biggest ways to help people to trust you is to be honest about the situation. Ever came across, if someone confronts me and says that, they don't trust even the fact that I'm standing in the barbershop trying to convince them to do something for the man, so to speak, my thing would be not to dispute or not to make them feel like they didn't have a right to be, to be suspicious or to have their suspicions about my presence in the barbershop, even though, there's the cultural, we're both black men. The thing is not to, you can't make them feel bad for being suspicious, because we've been through so much. So I would just embrace it. I would embrace it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the medical community, just being able to really call a spade and just, you know, let's not pretend that we don't have issues. If we admit that we have issues, that's a real way to let a person know. Now, we understand why you feel this way. And so, you know, let's tackle it together. Let's take a look at what this program really is, right? And what the positive effects will be if you participate, and see it as a way to start chipping away at a really big problem, which is you can't get the help we're trying to give you because you don't trust where it's coming from, and we understand. But if you participate, you can still, it will impact your health, which is the overall goal, you know, what we're trying to do, you know?
Right. David, we're getting to the end of our show, which makes me very sad because I have so many things I want to discuss with you.
I know.
But, David,
that
if you... I know. It goes by quickly. I know. But David, if you were, if you had this opportunity to talk to Black men today who are listening, to persuade them to be more proactive, what would you say to them? And also, you know, tell me about the important role of mothers, wives, sisters who can play a significant role in convincing them to take action.
Okay. So I think if I'm talking to any Black man or, you know, if any Black man that's listening to this program, I would say that ultimately health disparities research is here to do is to try and close the gap on in terms of the disproportionate way that Black men are impacted in regards to their health in different areas, prostate cancer, colon cancer, the list goes on, high blood pressure, things of that nature. I would just say that try and look at the outcomes, like the things that we're trying to accomplish, and see if it lines up with your own personal values, if it lines up with what you would like to achieve, even in your, just in your space, in your personal space, you know, with your family. Is this something that's going to impact you positively? And for the wives, I would say they tend to be the ones that kind of make Black men be more attentive in terms of their health. And I would say to them, just keep doing what you're doing. Keep encouraging your Black men to, you know, go to the doctor and take the initiative to maybe try and make some changes in your diet and things like that to try and promote your own health, you know, especially for your family, you know.
Yeah. So listen to those women, those strong women in your life.
Yeah, no doubt, because they have your best interests at heart, and they're not going to pull punches, you know, because...
And the family's interest, so. That's right. David, I can't believe we're at the end of the show. It has been such a pleasure talking with you today. I'm so grateful for the insights, experiences you shared with our listeners. And I do hope you'll come back, because I have a lot more that I want to discuss with you and a lot more questions for you, but it's been a pleasure having you. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. I'm Kim Thibodeau with the Cancer Support Community. We've got a host of free resources for patients and families in person, online, on the phone. Check us out at www.cancersupportcommunity.org. You could also call our helpline. Talk to one of our navigators at 888-793-9355. Again, check us out at cancersupportcommunity.org. I'm Kim Thibodeau. This is Frankly Speaking About Cancer. Until next time, be well, do well, live well.
Thank you for joining us for Frankly Speaking About Cancer with your host, Kim Thibodeau. We're here for you every Tuesday afternoon at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. In the meantime, stay connected online at cancersupportcommunity.org. That's cancersupportcommunity.org.